Hey everybody, I'm Cliff Gooding. I'm a grateful alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 15, 2001, and for that short amount of time, I'm as grateful as I know how to be. If you're here expecting to see Paul, you may be sorely disappointed. Although my mother's maiden name was Flanagan, if that counts, I'm not sure. But if you don't know Paul, you'll get that joke on Sunday afternoon, or Sunday morning, you will. So, I want to thank Ben, particularly in the committee, for inviting Lori and I to come and spend the weekend with you all here this weekend. It's it's a real treat to be here. There's a lot of people here, generally, but there's a lot of people here who I know and love. And so it's just wonderful to be with like-minded people. Seekers, really. I mean, that's what happens. That's who gathers at these places. Unless you're just voluntold to be here. People who show up for these events are seekers, and it's good to be among fellow seekers who are all got their oars in the water. We're rowing in the same direction. So it's a treat to be here. I love coming in early and listening to all the chatter when you get here. Isn't it? It's just beautiful. And it's like it being at the bar. Everybody talking, nobody listening kind of thing. You know, it's just beautiful, really, you know. But it's great to be here. I was telling Mike, my buddy Mike from Nashville, I was telling him earlier, I said, man, Mike, this is one of the best-looking bunch of sick people I've seen in a while, man. It's really good. And Riley's right. If you could see you all from here, you look just beautiful. You look beautiful. And it wasn't always beautiful looking around before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. But you guys look great tonight. Somebody asked me I was out greeting earlier, because they get you here, they really want you to work. And so I was greeting earlier. And I wandered back over by the registration table. What a fantastic job you guys are doing on registration. Thank you. Yeah. Phenomenal. Man. And somebody asked me, said, what's the hardest thing about conferences and going to? Is it the traveling? Is it the air delays? Is it the different hotels? What's the hardest thing? I thought about it. I didn't even have to think very long. I said, it's learning the cadence to the Lord's Prayer wherever you are. That, am I right, Bill? That's got to be the stumper. I mean, you know, because nobody does it the same. Oh, my God. However many states there are, that's how many different cadences there are. That's it, you know. So probably how many conferences there are, that's how many cases there are. But it's great to be here. And, you know, I like when we get together like this. And, you know, the deal is that why do we get together? Like, why do we come together like this? Why do we have these kind of big events? Why do we all gather in one spot to fellowship and bring all these people in? And why do we have birthday nights? Why do we celebrate anniversaries, group anniversaries? Why do we do all that stuff? Well, I'll tell you why we do all that stuff. What I can tell you is that if we dropped a pin right here and we went out maybe about a half a mile, might have to go a little further from right here. Let's just say a mile. If we dropped a pin and we went out about a mile and we just drew a circle and we started knocking on doors, and we started knocking on, we wouldn't get to very many doors before we would find this scenario. We would walk in into that house, if we could just rip the roof off and look inside, we would find somebody in the morning sitting at a kitchen table. And they're being really quiet. There's a couple of kids in the house. They're in their bedrooms, and they're being really quiet. Really, really quiet. And somewhere around 9:30 or 10, there'll be some movement in the back bedroom, and somebody will start coming down the hall. And they'll sit at that kitchen table with the other person, and they'll say something like this: I am so sorry. I am so sorry. You know, I didn't mean for X to happen last night. I didn't mean to do Y. And I can guarantee you one thing. This will never, ever happen again. And I'm willing to almost stake my whole sobriety is that on Sunday morning, that scenario will play out again. And that person will be drunk and have no more idea what happened. So why do we gather here? Why do we do this? That person would have no more idea that just within that mile, the solution to all their problems lie right here. So why do we come here like this? We come and gather at places like this and listen to each other and gather with each other, because on Monday, or whenever we return to our home groups, the next wave of insanity will crash our doors. And we come here to get re-energized, to remember why we do this, to remember on Monday morning or whenever you go to your home group, to remember, why do I still do this? Why do I still get up after 20, 30 years? Why do I do this after 18 months? Why am I still coming here? We do this to remember why. Because there's people in our midst and among us, fellow travelers, that have not yet heard the good news of what's happening right here. And the answers to the solution to their problems lie right here. And they'll lie in your home group, and they'll lie waiting when they crash it. So we come here for that. We come here to remember, to be re-energized, so we're boots on the ground, we're ready to go. And it's weekends like this that I love to be a part of, whether I'm here or whether I'm there. I'm grateful to be a part of that because I need to be reminded as well. Lori and I were on the airplane. We lifted off out of Atlanta on Wednesday. We got here on Wednesday. And we lifted up out of the air. This happens every once in a while. And the flight attendant, I mean, literally, we just barely took off. And the flight attendant comes on and says, there's a person on this plane who has a fatal allergy to nuts. So please, if you have any nuts with you, do not open them. Because this person is extraordinarily allergic. And I heard people groan, you know, kids groan. A couple of adults almost got in a fist fight over the peanut deal, you know. But my wife, a good member of the Al-Anon family group, just grabbed my arm and pulled me real tight. She said, Cliff, whatever you do, please don't tell them about your fatal allergy. Please don't tell them. Which, based on the first reaction to the peanuts, I thought was a good idea. I really did. I had a really good step 12 story ready for you all. I had about 3 hours to scrap that, right? And I was saying, I don't know how it is, but you know, you get something kind of later. And I volunteered for this, just so you know. So when I tell you this story, just know I volunteered for it, right? And I sat in my room, I thought, oh my God, you know. And I had to get up out of my room and come down with you people. I had to just kind of start mulling around with you to get kind of okay, acclimated back to step one. Somebody asked me, said, well, gosh, you were going to do step 12, and now you're doing step one. Can you do that? I said, I had 41 years to work out that step one deal. I think I'm pretty good on that, you know. I'm ready. I'm qualified, baby, you know. All right. Enough of that. So, long before I ever had a drink, I had this deal when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard somebody talk about it, and I thought, my God, these people are geniuses. They talked about restless, irritable, and discontentedness. And I thought, oh, this person's like some kind of genius. I thought, man, they're talking what I've been feeling my whole life, but I don't know how to express it. I don't have the words to say it. I don't know. I don't have the vocabulary, even though I'm educated way beyond my intelligence. I can't formulate the words. But when they said that in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought, that's it. That's how I've been feeling. Then later I found out they were cheating and reading out of the book. I didn't know that. I didn't know AA was an open book exam. I didn't know that. They talked about restless, irritable, discontent, and it resonated with me. It just resonated with me. Because that kind of internal struggle, that idea that, you know, I'm unhappy, dissatisfied, unsatisfied, particularly with my current circumstances, that discontentedness, well, that really resonates with me. Our friend Amy talks about the bedevilment. She talks about, I was bedeviled all my life. I identify with that. I identify with this bedevilment. I'm no use to anybody, subject to depression, all that stuff. I get that. And I felt that way, you know, from the very beginning. I mean, I felt that way, it seems to me like, as far back as I can remember. But I can certainly pinpoint it to when I was 5 years old. And I lived out in West Texas, and because that's where my family was, so I thought that was a good idea. So we were out. Do I look taller over there? I don't know. I don't think so. I look taller on Zoom. Some people are surprised, you know. No, this is as good as it gets right here, baby, you know. I have to tie a knot in my tag. Because if I don't, the ribbon gets wet when I go to the bathroom, so I have to tie it up. It's a bad deal, I'm just saying, you know. Anyway, she walked me into that, and my mama had me there early. I mean, I'm early. She had me spit shine that little red kindergarten. I mean, I got my shorts, I'm perma-pressed, I'm looking good, you know. Had that burr haircut. So much for that, you know. And so she walked me down that little schoolhouse, and early. And we walk in that door, and, there's probably 15 kids sitting at those little bitty low tables, you know. And, man, all their heads popped up and looked directly at me. And in that moment, this idea that we talk about, this conscious separation, I couldn't have described that to you. But those kids' head popped up, and it became all about me right then. Not that I'm not sure it wasn't about me before, but I can certainly trace it to that moment that the thoughts in my head, although I could not have articulated them, would have been something like this. These kids know the answers to all the questions, and I don't know what book they're reading out of. It's like I'm walking into a meeting 15 minutes late, but I'm early. It's like the feelings are is that I've got a 100-piece puzzle, but I'm missing a piece. And these kids all have theirs. It's that kind of idea. And I don't know where that comes from, this idea that I'm separated from you people. I love what our friend Larsine, a great member of the Al-Anon family groups, she says, you know, information floats through the universe. It lands on my head, and I begin to take action like it's the truth, you know. And that's how it was for me. I just in that moment thought these kids have it all together, and I don't. I don't know what causes that internal condition for a guy like me, this void almost that appears in me. And this idea that, you know, if I started out with this group over here and I hear what this group is doing, I think, man, that's such a better deal. I need to be over there with them. And it doesn't matter if I commit to you to be there. If I hear they're doing something better, I'll make up some excuse to be over here. Because I just think that sounds like a better deal for me. And I just do those kind of things because it's this compulsory need to be a part of something. Although I feel separated from. And I've heard that described by many, many, many alcoholics in many, many meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've heard it described by many, many alcoholics behind the podiums of Alcoholics Anonymous. This idea of separation that Chuck kind of talked about way back when, that conscious separation, separated from you and separated from God, this internal condition that I walk around with, the spiritual malady that Dr. Silkworth identified as restless, irritable, discontented, Bill Wilson flushed out as a bedevilment, to the best of their ability, trying to describe what that looks like, what that feels like for people like us. And I identify with that. I mean, I hook into that. And that kind of feeling just kind of follows me around, kind of like that cloud over that Charlie Brown character, you know, just kind of pervades me, which, by the way, if you're new or you're nearly new, we may sound like Charlie Brown's people this weekend. Let's just say that. You know. How many people here at your very first conference or roundup ever? How many people here? Yeah. How many people under 1 year sober? Yeah, that's good. Welcome. I should have said this to begin with, but because I'm so rattled by being step one, I forgot. So listen. If you're new or you're nearly new, you may have already dozed off at this point. But if you're still awake, maybe the clapping woke you up. I don't know. But if you're new or you're nearly new, please hear this if you don't hear anything else this weekend. You're wanted, welcomed, and needed in Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay? You're wanted, welcome, and needed here. And I hope over the course of the weekend, well, you're going to discover this, that I have one thing that's different from all these other speakers that you're going to hear this weekend. You'll want to hear them again. But the key component of Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe, is the identification process. It's the most valuable, if not the valuable tool that we have here. And so if those folks that are here that you're new or you're nearly new, that under that 1 year, if you're sitting here today debating about, am I alcoholic or not? I'm not real sure. I'll just kind of help you a little bit. People who are not alcoholic, well, first of all, they don't end up at conferences like this generally. But even if they did, they don't sit around saying, am I alcoholic or not? They just don't feel it necessary to just have that discussion. You know? They just don't. And so I hope you hear something this weekend, because I'm going to tell you something. The speakers this weekend are all my friends and my wife, who's also my friend. And these are some of the best deliverers of our message in Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you listen to these speakers this weekend and you begin to identify with them and you listen to their tales and you begin to identify, then you might be in the right place. But the key here is to give yourself an opportunity. Because I'll say this to you, my experience is this. When I'm out there, what Tara's going to talk about, this God deal, never had a shot at me out there. But always has had a shot at me in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I'm in here, what happens is God's intelligent agents, you people, have an opportunity to share, and we identify. We identify. So I hope you give yourself a chance to do that. Anyway, so this spiritual malady, I got it. I've got that stuff. When I was 11 years old, I grew up down in southeast Oklahoma. My mom and dad moved from Texas back to southeast Oklahoma where they were from. And again, since I was five, I came with them. And we lived out in the country, and we lived on a cattle ranch farm, whatever impresses you people, that's what it was. So, my brother and my dad had been out working cattle on this hot July day. And they came back, and I was 11 years old, and there was this big weeping willow tree. And my brother cracked open this tall boy can of Country Club malt liquor. Anybody in here ever drink Country Club malt liquor? Well, for the rest of you, that's God working in your life. Let's just say that right. Anyway, my brother opened that can, and he took a big drink, and he handed it to me. And I just took a big, because I'm with my brother. My brother's 10 years older than me. I took a big drink. I don't know how long it took us to knock out that tall boy can of Country Club malt liquor. But I can tell you this, at the end of that, the magic of alcohol had happened for me. And I say the magic of alcohol because that's kind of how our textbook describes it. It talks about this illusion created, this idea that once I started drinking that stuff, everything I described to you all about the malady seemed to go away. Just seemed to go away. It just seemed to dissipate and go away. And I'm going to tell you, my experience with alcohol is not one where on that day I blacked out, I puked, and it was the end of my social drinking. That's not my experience. I know that's some people's, but it wasn't mine. But I can tell you this, by the time I'm in senior in high school, I'm a daily drinker. Now, the legal drinking age in Oklahoma when I was growing up, it was 21 for guys and 18 for gals. So if you're a 16, 17-year-old kid in high school, very important to always have an older woman. Very important. Critical as actually. But my buddy and I had found this little Zippy Mart in the little town I grew up in, about 5,000 people. We found this little Zippy Mart that at 6:30 in the morning, the legal drinking age was old enough to get your money on the counter. And so he and I would scrape our quarters and dimes and together every night. We had a 0 hour class that met at like 7:30, I can't remember, but we would show up at that little Zippy Mart every day, and we'd scrape enough together to buy an 8-pack of Pony Millers, the champagne a bottle beer of. And we would split them right down the middle. I'd have 6 and he'd have 2. And I'd get that cool buzz on, and I could navigate around those kids and be okay. I could just be okay. I have kind of a curse or a blessing, depends on what it is. I have a photographic memory. I can tell you the toner cartridge is getting a little low these days, but nonetheless, I have a photographic memory. I've had it for as long as I can remember. And so it served me well, because what I could do is I could read the materials, go drinking, and come take the test and do well, because I could store it and just recall it and do well. So I do well in school. And I come from a family that is a good family. You know, our book talks about this idea, if I just had a better philosophy of life, if I just had this better moral code, if I just had that, I could live up to that. And I had all that. I mean, I came from a family that if I told you tonight that my mom and dad, over the time I was at their house, that I lived with their house and that they were on this earth, if I saw them take more than 6 drinks, I might be exaggerating. I mean, just not alcoholic, you know. I'm an adult child of non-alcoholic people. I got nobody to blame, you know what I mean? I just... And they just, you know, they just didn't drink. You know, my dad might have a half a cold beer on a hot day when he had been mowing the pasture or something. A half, you know. That baffled me later on, that how he could do that, you know. But I'm talking about good people that taught me right from wrong, you know. And they instilled that kind of stuff on me. The trouble is that I don't know how to apply that to my life. I don't know how to take those words and live them. I don't know how to do it. It's like everybody that I know, we're marching and we're going. And they say, okay, up here, we're going to go right. And I'm in. We're going to go right. And then as I'm beginning to make the curve, this thought comes to me. I wonder what is left, you know. I'll be back. I'm just going to go see. And I'm like that kid that you walk by the wall that says wet paint. I go, I don't know. Let me just see. Is it really? Don't push this button. What happens if you do? I'm that kid. I just got to know what happens. Why? I'm just that guy. And by the time I get to college, I'm a blackout drinker. And I just think that that's what everybody, I think when you drink, I think everybody's experiencing the same thing I am. I look around at people, I think they're drinking just like me. You know, when I think about in those days around those kids, it looked like everybody's drinking the same with me. So I don't ever quiz people about blacking out. I just think that's what happens when you drink. You time travel, you know. You start with Matthew, you end up with Bill. It's a bad night. You know what I mean? Right, Matthew? You know that. I'm time traveling. I just think that's what happens when everybody drinks, that everybody gets that same effect. And I went to law school down at the University of Oklahoma, and I graduated down there, and I went to, and again, because I have a photographic memory, I do well in school. I mean, I graduated in the top 5% of my class. Not because I'm that smart, it's because I've got a memory that allows me to retain and just regurgitate. So when I tell you I'm educated way above my intelligence, believe me about that, right? Otherwise, I wouldn't say, is it really wet paint? I wouldn't do that, right? And I remember when I got my first job out of law school. And maybe some of you can identify with this. I got my first job out of law school. And I remember going to work that day. And I had this thought just kind of overcame me. Is what if they find out? What if they find out, you know, this double life? More than most people, the alcoholic lives this double life. And it just began to pervade me. What if they find out? And about Wednesday of my very first week there, one of the partners came to me and said, Cliff, after work today, it's about 1:30, after work today, we're going to go out and we're going to have some cocktails. Now, I want you to think about this for just a minute. Now, I'm from the country. I mean, I didn't even know that wine had corks until I came to the city, right? I mean, Boone's Farm, come on. I mean, you know, Sonic Ice, I'm with it, man. Cocktails, that's what they did on that show, Dallas, man. They had cocktails on that show, right? That sounds sophisticated. I need to be a part of that. I need to be part of that. And so I don't know. He said, you know, we're going to go out and have some cocktails after work. Would you like to go? Now, I don't know how you drank, but this is how I drank. When people would ask me questions like that, I have questions. What time are we going? Where are we going? Who's going? I ask all those questions. And he looked at me and said something like, well, it's going to be me and you and two other people. It'll be four of us. We're going to go at 5:30. We're going to go down to Pinstripes, which is a bar in the Skirvin Hotel in downtown Oklahoma City. And out of my mouth came this, I'll get the table. Because I don't know how you drink, but let me just tell you this. If Shaylin looked at all of us and said, hey, we're going to go out drinking Saturday night, and we're going to go at 9 o'clock. I'm in. But I'm going to tell you this. I don't wait to 9 o'clock to start drinking. I start drinking at 6 to get ready to go drinking, right? Just don't go drinking. Get ready to go drinking. And so I'm going to get the table. Now, I didn't know that about myself then. I don't know that I suffer from alcoholism. I just think I like to party. I don't know that once I start drinking, something different happens to me than 90% of the population. I also don't know that when I stop drinking, that something different happens to me than 90% of the population. And the reason I spent so much time at the first talking about the malady is because that's the chief activator of when I'm not drinking. That's the hardwire into when I'm not drinking. The spiritual malady is always what juices me back to drinking again. But so I go at 4:30 to get the table, so I'm there knocking back for an hour before they're getting ready to drink. I'm getting ready to drink. And so they show up about 5:30 at the appointed time because they're prompt. And that cocktail waitress comes over and she takes their order. And she serves them. Of course, I've been there for a while. She already knows what I need. I'm a vodka rocks guy. Sometimes don't even need rocks. But I'm with people, so, you know. And I need you to know that I'm not a sipper. There may be some sippers in here. I'm not a sipper. I mean, you bring me a vodka rocks, bam, next. I'm a drinker. I drink. I'm not pussyfooting around about this stuff, right? So she brings them drinks, and then she leaves. In about 10 or 15 minutes, she comes back, and this is the scene that night. She looks at the first person. Now, this person has about a quarter of a drink left in his glass and looks at this person and says, would you like another? And he says this, no, you know what? My wife is cooking dinner, and I got to get home. And with a quarter of a drink on the table, this guy gets up, pays his bill, gets in his car, presumably goes home to his wife. I don't know, you know. Has dinner with her, doesn't have another drink, maybe tonight, tomorrow, next week, next month. I don't know. She looks at the second person. Now, this lady has a half a glass left in her drink. She says, would you like another? She says, no. My daughter has a soccer game in 30 minutes. I got to go. With a half a drink on the table, pays her tab, gets up, gets in her car, goes to her daughter's soccer game, finds her early there, gives her a hug, tells her she loves her, goes and sits in the stands with the other parents. This is critical. Does not get thrown out of the soccer game, okay? You too, huh? Okay. Afterwards, the parents go have pizza and beer. She may or may not have another drink tonight, tomorrow, next month, next year. I don't know. But then there's this third person. Now, this is somebody I know all of you have encountered in your drinking careers. Isn't it interesting? Drinking careers. Right? Love how our book says that. Buddy of mine says, drunks ought to have trading cards, right? Have our stats on them, right? Two DUIs, you know. Seven public intoxes. Major leaguer, you know. So this other person, this last person there, this person has like three quarters of her drink left. Or maybe it's the worst case scenario, right? The ice is melting and the booze is overflowing. Now, in this crowd, that's alcohol abuse. I know that. But the waitress looks at her and says, would you like another? And she says the strangest thing of all. She says, no, I don't care for anymore. I'm beginning to feel it. Okay. All right. And I think, okay, because now we're going to order tequila shots, man, because if you're feeling it, there's a window that you're about to crawl through. I mean, I don't know about you people, but when I'm feeling it, there's a time clock on me, because three things are about to happen, right? I mean, there's some things that's going to happen. There's three conditions where I quit: pass out, run out, blackout, period. Period. And I can tell you this. There's always something happens at the end of the night when I'm drinking. Something always happens. You know, I don't know when it's going to be, where it's going to be, or who's going to be involved in it, but something always happens when I'm drinking. And if it was just that, right? It was just that idea that when I drink, something different happens to me. This idea that when that lady says, I don't want anymore, I'm beginning to feel it. What she's saying is that the effect of alcohol produced in her is she begins to feel impaired. And she doesn't like how that makes her feel, so she's done. See, that's not the effect of alcohol on me. The effect of alcohol produced in me is I don't begin to feel impaired. I begin to feel empowered. And we're getting ready to get up and do some Jekyll and Hyde kind of stuff around here. That's what I'm telling you. We could possibly be on a personal adventure at any moment, right? Maybe an alcoholic expedition. I'm not sure. It could happen. Pass out, run out, blackout. I'm going to the end. I'm just done. And if it was just that, if it was just the allergic reaction that we talk about here, that idea that I just like to drink, that I just like to party, I don't know that it's the effect produced in me that once I drink, this phenomenon of craving kicks in on me. That once I begin to drink, all bets are off. I don't know if it's going to be 2 or 22. I don't know. It's all bets are off. If it was just that. I mean, if it was just an allergic reaction to alcohol, then somebody like my sweet wife or any of the other three of my sweet wives, if they would have just said to me, Cliff, you're just allergic to alcohol, stop. You guys have a different speaker tonight. If that was all that was to it. Because I know people who are allergic to stuff. You all people know people who are allergic to stuff. You know people who are like lactose intolerant. They just stay away from milk. Right? You probably people know people who are allergic to like strawberries, bee stings. Right? But for God's sake, the peanut people. You probably know some of those people. Huh? Man, the peanut people are something else, aren't they? Well, y'all brought it up. Let's talk about them. All right. The peanut people. I mean, these people make one emergency room visit. And they quit forever. Wrap your head around that, man. They make one emergency room visit. I'm done forever. They don't need to go to Peanut Anonymous. And they don't need a Peanut Anonymous sponsor. They don't buy the PA book. They don't do that, you know. Hey, where's that big Snickers book? I need to see that, you know. So, nothing like that. They don't do anything like that. As a matter of fact, when they go to a restaurant, they'll say things like this to the maitre d', has a peanut been on this city block? I need to know, man, is it on the block? Because they're vigilant about that. They have one bad reaction to peanuts. Dude, they're serious. Let me talk about my allergic reaction to alcohol. I'll give away cars, houses, jobs, careers, families, children, my integrity, my dependability, your stability. I never connect the dots. It's the booze. I never connect the dots that once I take a drink, all bets are off. I just think I like to party. Our book tells us, you know, that I've lost the power of choice in drink. The choice is already made for me. Alcohol is my drug of no choice. It's my drug of no choice. I'm drinking. So those two things, the two pieces of this dragon that we have, this malady, this allergic reaction. But there's this other piece. It's that third piece of alcoholism, right? That obsession of the mind, that after about 23, all our book focuses on that. That if an alcoholic never takes the first drink, everything we've talked about is academic. It's a good theoretical discussion, but if the alcoholic never takes a drink, all that stuff is just theory. That whole allergy of the body, theory. If the alcoholic never takes a drink. But it's the other piece of alcoholism. It's the third head of the dragon. It's the piece that make the people who have never taken a drink of alcohol in their life die early. Suffer from heart failure, hypertension, high blood pressure. Never take a drink. It's the people that stay up waiting for us, worried about us, wondering about us. Those people who never take a drop of alcohol, yet are affected by alcohol just as much. Those people. And that looks something like this. I'll come home, Lori will be cooking dinner, it's Thursday. And I walk in and she's cooking dinner and she says, dinner will be ready in an hour, we need bread. And she says, you need to go to the store and get bread. I go, yes, ma'am. And off I go to the store. And I go into Homeland, I get a loaf of bread, I'm coming out, and I run into Ben. And Ben looks at me and he says, what are you doing? And I said, well, Lori's at home cooking dinner. I look at my watch, it's going to be ready in 50 minutes, and I got to get home. And Ben looks at me and he says, 50 minutes? Well, 50 minutes? Well, hey, man, we could go over to the log in, have a couple of beers, you'll be home in 50 minutes. Now, when I get information like that, Rachel, I filter that through the keen alcoholic mind, right? And you people know about the keen alcoholic mind. Because Alcoholics Anonymous is the only place anybody ever talks about the keen alcoholic mind. I can guarantee you one thing. In the Al-Anon rooms, they are not talking about the keen alcoholic mind over there, man. Never comes up, actually. But I filter Ben's statement through my keen alcoholic mind. I think, two beers, 50 minutes, I can do that. So on a Thursday night, Ben and I go to the log in to have two beers. Now, Sunday, when I get home, everybody's mad at me. She's mad. The kids are mad. Dog, cat, hell, they're mad. I don't know why. I got the bread, right? I mean, I got it. And I don't know if you've ever worked your way into a jackpot like that or not, but when I get in a jackpot like that, I like to tell the story. Because, by God, everything we do involves a story. I will promise you this tonight. Over the weekend, somebody will go to the bathroom and come back to their group and go, you're not going to believe this, right? And just have a multi-level story that goes with it. That's just how we roll. Stories. But I start telling the story. Home, dinner, hour, bread, store, 50 minutes, bin. And when I get to that part of the story, something in my head goes, there's the problem. Bin is the problem. Well, I know you people know this. And the crazy part about that, when my head says, there it is, Ben's the problem, I believe that. I believe Ben is the problem. And so what happens, there's a total dynamic shift in the way I tell the story. I now tell it from the perspective that Ben is the problem. And you could strap a lie detector on me and I'll pass it, that I firmly believe that, man, if I hadn't run into Ben, I'd been home and you wouldn't be mad and it would all be okay. It would all be okay. And I get to the end of my story and I'm just like that person that stumbles out of his bedroom to how I started this story tonight. And I sit across from my wife and I say, but I can guarantee you one thing, or I'll promise you one thing, or I'll swear one thing, this will never happen again. And here's the crazy part about that. I believe that too with all my heart. I will bet my life I'm not drinking again. You know why? I don't ever want to look in those eyes again. You know the eyes. You sat across some people that love you more than anything else. You sat across some people just like me that if anybody else on this earth treated them the way you treated them, you'd kill them. You take them in your front yard, you beat them to death. But I'll look her in the eye and I'll say, I promise you this, baby, it'll never be this way again. I'll never do it again. Never do it again. I go to bed, I get up the next morning, still pretty frosty at my house. I get in my car and I go to work. Now, on my way to work, I start thinking about work. And I think about, they don't really respect me down there at work. I mean, I'm down there busting my ass 2 or 3 hours a day. I'm killing it at work, man. I mean, I get there, doors start shutting, you know, that kind of deal. By 1 o'clock, I'm done, you know. Back in my car, driving home again, and this thought hits me. I don't know why they're mad at me. I apologized yesterday. When that thought hits me, I could stretch it maybe 24 hours. But most likely when that thought hits me, I don't know why they're still mad at me. So suddenly the script flips and it's their fault. It's them. It's never me. The script flips one more time. I don't know why they're mad at me. But generally it's 2 or 3 hours and I find myself at a bar or I'm at those guys' house or I'm 2 drinks in thinking, how'd this start again? I don't even remember driving here. Because when the obsession's on me, it's almost like a whiteout. I'm like on autopilot. I just go and I just drink. And that's alcoholism. And I have that. Those stories are me multiplied and multiplied and multiplied. I could have started tonight with this story and it would have summed up my entire drinking career. When I came home from my very first treatment center in 1988, I was 7 when I went. No, I was 27. When I came home from my first treatment center, my wife loves this story. It's the only reason I'm telling it, because she loves it so much. I came home from this treatment center. My second wife had served me divorce papers on our 1-year anniversary. You know it's not going good when that happens, you know. Probably a bad day. And so I'd gone to treatment because some people thought I had a problem. I certainly didn't believe that, you know. But anyway, I came home. We had been divorced, and I got the house, but she got all the neighbors. It's a bad deal. And the couple that lived to the west of me, they had 2 little boys. And the youngest one, who was about 5 years old, was outside playing when I got home. And I go outside, been gone for 30 days. I go outside, and this little kid comes up to me and says, hey, Cliff, where you been? And, you know, what do you say to a five-year-old? I can't say, well, I've been to treatment. I said, oh, you know what? I've just been gone. And he looks at me and goes, oh, my mom says you're probably in jail. And you know she probably said it more than once, right? But that's my life. That's how my life looks. That everybody around me thinks he's probably in jail. If I've disappeared, if I've gone at large, as our book talks about, I'm probably in jail. Because I just go. When I start drinking, I just got to go. And you know, I'm in Norman, Oklahoma, and it's a Sunday night. I've been drinking since Friday. You know, I'm just pounding them away. And it's about 10 o'clock at night. I've been drinking all day. And I got to go to the bathroom. And I like to tell this story because I think it's very profound, particularly with this many women in the room. I always feel the need to kind of describe this because I had to go to the bathroom that night. And the ladies who I know, everybody, ladies here, never been to a men's restroom before. So let me set the tone here. There's all kind of different men's restrooms. You know, there's really nice facilities like this, dividers, you know, all that kind of stuff. But sometimes you go to these bars and it's just like big hog trough. We're all going to belly up to it, right? So this is a hog trough night, okay? Very key here. So I go, I'm in there. It's about 10 o'clock at night. This guy comes in and he's busy. I mean, he's got something going on over here. And it catches my attention. Now, ladies, what you need to know is this, that if you're in a men's restroom and there's a guy next to you, don't ever get caught looking at him. That's key, right? This is imperative here. Well, he caught me, you know. But he pulled out what appeared to be the world's smallest baby spoon. And he started doing things. It was weird, that's all I tell you. Let me tell you about my alcoholism. I've got rules about my drinking. I got rules. One of the fundamental rules is no drugs. We don't do drugs. Well, I mean, I'll smoke some reefer with you, but I'm talking about drugs. You know what I mean? Well, this guy had all this stuff going over here, and I'm fascinated. I mean, just never seen anything like that before. I mean, he's taking this little spoon, putting this powder up his nose, and he caught me. And some things I don't know about me. I don't know that I'm governed by 100 forms of fear. I don't know that. Don't know that. But this guy caught me, and what he did is he just dug in there, and he took that out, and in the, like, 2 seconds, he took it to put under my nose. The thought came to me was this: what will he think of me if I don't do that? What will he think of me? Now, I got rules. Don't do that. But the thought came, what will he think of me if I do that? Don't do that. And so he just... I did what he did. Right? One nose, then the other. Here's what you need to know about that night. Every time that guy went to the bathroom, I followed him in there. I became the unofficial night watchman in my neighborhood for a number of years after that. People say to me sometimes, you shouldn't tell drug stories in AA. I don't really think that's a drug story. I don't. And I'll tell you why I don't think that. Because I'll make all kind of commitments to myself about what I will and will not do. I'll draw hard lines that I'm never doing this, I'm never doing that. But let me tell you something. When you put beverage alcohol in this body, a different guy starts calling the shots in my life. A different person starts calling how my life's going to be. They start telling me, alcoholism starts telling me what I will and I won't do. Because it's never been about the drinking. You know, people always get, particularly new alcoholics, get real quiet when I say that. Because if it was just about the drinking, we'd stop and we'd go home. And no one would be here this weekend. No one would be here. We'd tell this story right here, we'd all go home. You wouldn't need the other stories. You wouldn't need them at all. We'd be a one-step program. Just don't drink, and we'd go home. But it's something other than that. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody said to me, So you're in the easy part of Alcoholics Anonymous, like the first 30 days. Oh, you're in the easy part of the program, the stop drinking. And I'm like, what are you talking about, Dad? I'm dying over here, right? And I'm always hesitant to say this around new people because all their life they've heard the same thing we've all heard. If you just don't drink. I mean, our families look at us and say, just stop drinking. If you just don't drink, please stop drinking. If you don't drink, it'll be okay. Let me tell you something. If I just don't drink, I'm going to kill myself. That's the truth. It's never been about drinking. But to the whole world, it appears to be that. Because we don't have drinking problems in this room tonight. We have drinking solutions. And I'm going to tell you something. I had friends that I grew up with. And they looked like me. And we would come home at Christmas and they would look like me. We would go out and burn it down, right? From Christmas to New Year, it'd be scorched earth policy. And something crazy happened to those people. They met him, they met her, they got good jobs, so they just quit. They just quit. You know what happened when those people quit? Those people that had a drinking problem, when they quit, you know what happened? Their lives got better. They got promotions at work. They got married to those people. They start having kids, start buying houses, bigger houses. They got those things called 401ks, that kind of stuff, you know. If you're a drinker, you ever look at your Social Security statement? I've got zeros in some years on mine, man. Proud of that. But they quit drinking, their life gets better. In the summer of 2001, when I got kicked out of my house, which I would like to tell you was the final time, but not. When I got kicked out of my house and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, not because I thought I had a drinking problem or not because I thought I was alcoholic. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for one reason and one reason only. I had one problem that summer, homelessness. That was my problem. And I'd been to AA when I went to that treatment center in the 80s. And so I thought, I can come to AA and I'll tell Lori that I'm coming to AA. And then when she settles down and I get back in the house, I'll go back and live my life the way I want to do it. And that was June of 2001, not my sobriety date, because I made it 45 days just not drinking, going to Alcoholics Anonymous, sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, just not drinking and going to meetings. And I'm going to tell you something. On the 45th day, I got up out of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not like those people. When I just stop drinking, what happens is 41 years of restless, irritable discontent slams me every day. The four horsemen show up at my bed and they ride with me all day long. All day long. And on the 45th day, my decision is I'm either drinking or killing myself. Because I am so miserable here. And all my life, I think if I can get the picture out there okay, I'll be okay. In the summer of 2001, I'm dying inside, sitting in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, just not drinking and going to meetings. And I got up out of that meeting and I started drinking on a Thursday. Guess when I came home? Sunday. Nobody's glad to see me. Lori, there was some discussion about whose house it was. Come to find out on that night, again, more hers than mine. Got thrown out of the house again. I like to tell you, that was the last time I got thrown out. But that's a different talk. And I came back to AA. I'd like to tell you that I came back to AA on August the 15th of 2001 because I just had this desperate need to get sober. I'd like to tell you that on August 15th, when Lori kicked me out and I detoxed on this guy's couch for 2 days and I walked back into rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was like I knew, my God, my problem, this is my problem. I'm alcoholic. I need AA. I wish I could tell you that, but no. I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, the revised newcomer plan, to get back in the house because that was, again, my problem, homelessness. I thought it might take me 90 days for her to settle down this time, you know. And I got to get over that 45-day hump thing, right? But I had no thought of getting sober that day. And so if you're new or you're nearly new, please hear this, because this is my experience. You don't have to want to get sober to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's my experience. You don't have to want to get sober to get sober here. That's my experience. I didn't want to get sober. I had no thought of getting sober. No thought about getting sober. I'm just worried about how to get back in the house. But I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Charlie Brown's people are there. Wonk, wonk, wonk. And I've got like 5 minutes left in the meeting. And I'm a chatterhead. I mean, I've got things up there, you know. I mean, people talked about the committee. My God, if I could have got it to a committee, that would have, I might not even be here if I could have got it to a committee, man. I've got a full bore stockholders meeting going on up there, and everybody's pissed, right? And I don't know about you how alcoholism looks in your life, but alcoholism never visits me at 3 in the afternoon. It's 3 in the morning. Clip, get up. We've been up for a couple hours. We need you in here. Okay. All right. We got a lot to talk about. Here's the agenda. You're still worthless. Okay. And they just go. And they won't be quiet. And it's full of woulda, coulda, shouldas. It's all that stuff that I'm never going to see. I'm always looking back or I'm looking forward. I'm never right here, right now. I'm time traveling. And with 5 minutes left in that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, that chatterhead went stone cold quiet. And this thought came to me. If you don't do something different today, you're going to die. And you good people stood up 5 minutes later, held hands, said the Lord's Prayer. And after that prayer, I did the same thing I had been doing for the 45 days prior to that. I broke for the door. Why? Because I'm a runner. See, I got a problem I can't solve. You got a solution I don't want. There's nothing for me here. I can't connect the dots on that, but I'm just out of here. And what I didn't tell you was for those 45 days that I had been going to Alcoholics Anonymous before August the 15th of 2001, there'd been an old man there. And every day after those meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, when I would start to leave, old Don would catch me. And he would look at me and say, "Bub, how are you doing?" And I would give him the alcoholic answer, "Fine, fine, fine. Nothing to see here, Ma." Fine. And he would look at me and he would say, "Well, listen, if there's ever anything I can do for you, let me know." And I would think, if there is, I'm gone. And on August the 15th of 2001, I broke for that door one more time and Don caught me one more time. And Don looked at me and he said, "Bob, how are you doing?" And on that day, I gave him a different answer. I looked at him and I said, "Man, Don, I'm not doing very good." And he just looked at me and he said, "I know." Let me tell you about Don. You know, I'm not really a product of a guy who was working a perfect first step on August the 15th of 2001. I'm a product of a guy who was working a perfect 12th step. On August the 15th of 2001. We'll tell you about Don. Don believed if you are at the meeting 30 minutes before it starts, you're late. You're late, you know. And he would get there and he'd set the tables up, put the books out, do all that stuff. And he would have some of those, I would describe them as acolytes out there. They'd be, all they know is read, write, pray. That's all they know out there, you know. They would float into the meeting, you know, and if they're, I don't know how they do it where you guys go to meetings, I'm sure it's wrong, but in Oklahoma, what they do, they eventually say, "Is there any AA-related announcements?" And Don would go on for like, it seemed like forever, 35, 40 seconds. I mean, forever. Talk about everything going on worldwide. And if there was a newcomer at the meeting, Don would be on them like a chicken on a June bug, man, just attack mode, you know. And those acolytes would be getting numbers and giving numbers, you know, whatever, writing in those books. Oh, Don would hang back. Certainly he would give his number, but he would get a number because he knew something the acolytes didn't know. No alcoholic can pick up a 10,000-pound phone. Can't happen, right? So he'd get their number, right? He'd call you. Don would call you. I hope you have somebody like Don in your life. I hope you do. And Don looked at me and he said, well, listen, if there's ever anything I can do for you. See, Don never one time in that 45 days grabbed me and said, listen, this is what you need to do. You get a book, go to meetings, whatever. He never did any of that to me. What he would do is he would offer me friendship and fellowship. And when I wasn't interested in that, he would step aside and he let whiskey do the job. Just let whiskey do the job. So on August the 15th, when I gave him a different answer, he looked at me and he said, well, listen, if there's ever anything I can do for you, let me know. And my head said, man, there's nothing you can do for me. There's nothing you can do for me. But out of my mouth came, I need a sponsor. And I'm going to tell you something. Don got really excited. He started gyrating around. I thought he was going to pee his pants. I'll tell you the truth about it. And he said, let's sit down and talk about that. I thought that's a good idea. It'll be contained if he pees. I said, good. But what Don did for me on that day is he began to talk the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how many meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous I've been in, but I'm a firm believer of this. I can't hear you till I'm able to hear you. You know, we talk about consequences in here. We talk about bottoms. The book describes it as incomprehensible demoralization. I'm going to tell you, it's just grace. It's just grace. It doesn't matter what kind of consequences I suffer, but what has to happen for a guy like me, I believe, for me, it's my experience, is that on that day, on August the 15th of 2001, I had an internal implosion of self that I broke internally. And the right person showed up and he carried a beneficial message to me. He carried a message of depth and weight. He was a man familiar with what he suffered from. And he talked to me about his drinking. And when he talked to me about his drinking, for the first time, I heard it. And I heard it. And I don't know how long Don and I sat there together. But at the end of that discussion, which was his discussion, and I'm listening. At the end of that, what I can tell you about me is this. On August the 15th, 2001, I pushed all my imaginary AA chips to the middle of the table, and I went all in on Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been all in. I've been all in on Alcoholics Anonymous from that date to this moment right here. And I'm a guy that's made a lot of mistakes in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a guy that's had some ups and downs in AA. But that's not my purpose tonight. My purpose is to say to you this, if you're new or you're nearly new, you don't ever have to drink again if you don't want to. Because there's hope here. And it doesn't matter, you know, when we get here, we have all kind of things happen to us. We have these great things and not so great things happen to us here. And we have, people get married and people die, and those can be good or bad depending on what page you're on at any given time. They could be tragic. I don't know. But that's life. And what Alcoholics Anonymous has prepared me for this alcoholic for, is that good or bad, what I've come here because I'm sold on step one. Because I know who I am and what I am. That I can't drink, and that I can't not drink. And left to my own devices, if I get away from you people, and I don't do what all the other speakers are going to talk about this weekend, I'll drink again. It's not a if, it's not a maybe, it's a lock that I'll drink again. And that's why it's important for you to know and for me to know. I'm Cliff, and I'm an alcoholic. Thanks.
Man, that was an electric way to start it off, wasn't it? Cliff, thank you.